You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, contact tracing will be increasingly important as Wisconsin reopens, but what does that process actually look like? A new report from WisConText gives us a closer look. Now, for weeks, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo claimed that COVID-19 began at a lab in China, though he has said he can't be completely sure. The theory goes against what intelligence experts and international analysts have been saying. They believe the virus came into human contact quite likely at a wet market in Wuhan. Here's Pompeo earlier this month on ABC's This Week.
We've said from the beginning that this was a virus that originated in Wuhan, China. We took a lot of grief for that from the outset, but I think the whole world can see now. Remember, China has a history of infecting the world, and they have a history of running substandard laboratories. These are not the first times that we've had a world exposed to viruses as a result of failures in a Chinese lab. And so while the intelligence community continues to do its work, they should continue to do that and verify so that we are certain. I can tell you that there is a significant amount of evidence that this came from that laboratory in Wuhan.
But over the weekend, Pompeo told Breitbart that U.S. officials don't know from where or from whom the virus began, just that it happened in that part of the world. So what's the story behind the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and why do scientists believe it doesn't have anything to do with the COVID-19 pandemic? Eliza Barclay is the science and health editor at Vox, where she oversees their health, science, energy, and environmental coverage. Eliza, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you wrote a piece, Eliza, where you talked to a bunch of virology experts about labs and the origins of the disease. What in the scientific community is our best working idea of where and how this virus originated?
Well, there are a lot of scientists who study emerging infectious diseases who specialize in exactly this question, because there's plenty of precedent for viruses that circulate in animals spilling over to humans. We've seen this many times before. The first SARS virus spilled over from animals, Ebola. Of course, different strains of flu, avian flu, for instance. So there have been so many times when this has happened before. And in fact, scientists expected that at some point or another, another virus, dangerous virus, would emerge and spill over from animals to humans. Bats, it turns out, carry around a lot of viruses, including coronaviruses. Scientists have studied several of these coronaviruses and have predicted that an event like another spillover that resulted in a virus that could be transmitted between humans that originated in bats was a highly likely event. As it turns out, this new virus, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, does appear to have originated from bats. We still don't know exactly how it leapt from bats to humans, but all the scientific signs point to that as the event that started all of this.
I want to look at this lab idea now. For a while, there was something floating around, including from a U.S. senator, an idea that this was a lab-engineered virus coming from this lab in China. It looks like, correct me if I'm wrong, it's a slam dunk that is not what happened here. Do I have that right?
Yeah, so it's a fascinating part of the story of this pandemic that has, of course, provoked all this speculation, which is that in the same city where the first cases appeared, where doctors first recognized that there was a new virus circulating and making people sick, the city of Wuhan, that also happens to be the only city in China with a BSL-4 biosafety lab, which is a lab where they study the most dangerous viruses. Now, there are labs like this around the world. We have a few in the U.S. And this is the first one that China has had. It built it several years ago. And so a lot of people immediately thought, well, gosh, that's quite a coincidence. What if the virus came from there? And from that point, there emerged several conspiracy theories about how this might have happened. One of them was that, oh, maybe China was developing this virus as a bioweapon and intentionally released it on the world. There's a bunch of reasons why that is clearly not true. One of them being that this is not a bioweapon like virus. The second one is what you referred to, which is that, oh, maybe this was an engineered virus. Now, the main reason that seems to be not true is that the virus SARS-CoV-2, it appears to be totally novel. Like it's not that similar to any other viruses that exist. And virologists say that they can't imagine how a human being could have engineered some of the aspects of the virus's genome a human wouldn't have thought of this, basically. That's what one virologist said to me. Like, humans couldn't have dreamed this up because there are just some very strange and novel aspects of the virus's genome that just don't appear to have been possibly engineered by humans. And then the third major conspiracy theory, which the Trump administration has latched on to most recently, is that, oh, okay, so maybe it wasn't a bioweapon, maybe it wasn't intentionally engineered, but what if it was a virus that was being studied in the lab that just accidentally leaked out? Maybe it was a virus they had isolated from nature, and then they were doing studies on it, and then it leaked out. And I talked to a bunch of scientists who have worked with with the people at the Wuhan Virology Lab, who, by the way, you know, they're part of an international community of scientists who collaborate. They have the same safety protocol as labs in the U.S. That, in fact, they were trained. A lot of the Chinese scientists were trained by U.S. researchers to have the same safety protocols. And so these scientists who worked with them, who I talked to, said, we just don't see that as plausible that they would have been so careless. You know, a lot of things would have had to happen for that to happen. Yes, there have been lab leaks in the past. Of course, it has happened and it is a concern. But in this case, there's just no evidence that it happened. And I'll just add quickly that intelligence officials have also said that they think that if it had accidentally leaked from the lab, that the Chinese officials would have been extremely alarmed about that, and that intelligence would have been able to pick up on that early in the pandemic. And there was never any sign that the Chinese officials were worried that this was a lab leak.
We're talking to Eliza Barkley from Vox. She wrote about the origins of the COVID-19 virus, interviewed a bunch of virology experts about different theories that have floated around about the origins of the virus that causes COVID-19. And a core of your piece on this, Eliza, is kind of comparing the likelihood that some kind of diseases would spread from animals to humans, especially in places in China where there's a lot of overlap between where humans live and where bats live, versus the likelihood of, not impossible, as you say, but the remote likelihood of a lab accident. Could you talk about how the scientists you talked to weighed those two probabilities?
Yeah, I thought this was really fascinating and very clarifying, because I think when we hear, when we hear it's actually extremely likely that a human in China or in another country in Southeast Asia, where there are lots and lots of bats carrying viruses like this one, that it's actually likely that one of them could infect a human, that's a very likely event. And it's why scientists have been worried about a pandemic like this for a long time. It's hard for us to understand, but part of the thing is that there are just a lot more bats in this region. And then there's all these ways in which humans and bats are interacting. For instance, people are trading them. So they're going into caves, they're collecting them, they're trading them. In some cases it's for food, but in other cases it's other things. People use bat guano on their fields as a fertilizer. People live right next to bat caves. So it's just a different kind of culture and a different sort of ecological situation. And so these scientists say, hey, you know, there's a million ways in which a human could have been infected by a bat carrying a virus like this. This is an event that we think is likely, you know, and actually we expect it to happen again. It's such a likely possibility. We expect it to happen again. And so we should actually be setting up surveillance systems so that we could detect something like this next time, such that it doesn't start to spread around the world, since we think it's actually such a likely event to happen. Whereas a lab accident, okay, yes, they've happened before, but they're actually more unlikely.
As we wrap up, Eliza, people are still, I assume, looking for that initial point of origin where the first human contracted this virus, but we may never find it. That's a possibility we might have to live with, right?
That's right. We may or we may not ever find it. One thing I'm heartened this week about is that, you know, for the last couple months, we didn't hear anything from China about the status of the investigation into the origin. They've been very quiet, but pressure has been mounting on China to do this investigation and do it in a transparent way so that we can learn, or at least we can know how are they looking into this in hopes that someday, yes, we get an answer. And just this week on Monday at the World Health Assembly, the Chinese leader said that indeed they will allow an investigation and they'll collaborate with the World Health Organization and other international investigators. They're sort of suggesting they might want to wait until the end of the pandemic, which, as we know, might be a very long time from now. But it's at least a good sign to hear them saying they want to get to the bottom of this, too, and they'll collaborate with international researchers to do so.
Eliza, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Eliza Barclay is the science and health editor at Vox, where she oversees their health, science, energy, and environmental coverage. We talked with her about the origins of the virus that causes COVID-19. Coming up, we'll talk about contact tracing efforts here in Wisconsin and tens of millions of dollars in new funding for the program announced by Governor Evers yesterday. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump says he's been taking an unproven drug to protect against the novel coronavirus. We'll find out what he's saying and the response in Congress during our roundup of national politics. First, Governor Evers announced $1 billion in federal funding yesterday that will go towards efforts to combat the coronavirus. The funding includes $75 million for contact tracing, a process that's expected to become increasingly important for containing the virus as Wisconsin continues to reopen. Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisContext. He recently took a closer look at contact tracing efforts and where they stand right now in Wisconsin. Will, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, remind us what contact tracing is.
Yeah, that's a good thing to do right off the bat, for sure. So contact tracing is the process by which contact tracers, who are often public health nurses or increasingly other people who are being hired to do contact tracing, the process by which they seek out and try to get in contact with the people who were close physical contacts of people who have tested positive for COVID-19. So for COVID-19, a close physical contact would be anyone who has had 15 minutes or more contact within 6 feet of someone who has tested positive for COVID.
And this is kind of part two of what people are saying we need, right, to reopen safely instead of closing everything down. If we have enough testing, and then contact tracing, so we could take those tests and do something with that information. This, public health experts are telling you, is key.
Exactly. Yeah, I heard that testing for COVID-19 really is not all that important or effective as a public health measure without contact tracing attached to it. And that's because contact tracing allows us to hopefully cut those chains of transmission. So the whole idea is that when a contact tracer reaches out to a close contact of someone who's tested positive, they can provide them with really useful health information. They can interview them, or rather they do interview them, about any signs or symptoms that they may be having that could be associated with the illness. And then they also instruct them to self-quarantine for up to 2 weeks.
And you write that this is something that local public health departments have been doing all along, not for COVID because we didn't have it, but for certain types of illnesses, contact tracing is something we already do.
Exactly. Yeah. Contact tracing is a public health mainstay. It's used all the time to help cut transmission of sexually transmitted diseases. It's also used to help cut transmission of measles and tuberculosis. So, yeah, it's something that public health professionals are very familiar with.
But with a quickly spreading disease, are we seeing the potential for a local government, a local public health department to be overwhelmed if there is even a medium-sized outbreak of COVID-19 in their area?
Yeah, we're totally seeing that potential for sure. Local health departments are not necessarily staffed up, or were not at the beginning of the pandemic, staffed up to do the type of really robust contact tracing that would be required if a large, or as you said, even a medium number of cases were to crop up in a community. That's especially the case in smaller communities or areas where the health department may be less funded than in some of our larger cities.
What have we seen at the state level? What particular efforts are they doing to ramp up the number of contact tracers in Wisconsin?
That's a really good question. They are in the process of hiring a whole number of contact tracers that they hope will provide kind of what they're calling surge support for local health departments. So the idea is that local health departments are best situated to conduct contact tracing, because another thing that contact tracers do is help contacts find social services if they need them, or figure out a situation that allows them to self-quarantine. Some folks are single mothers and may have children at home and may not be able to self-quarantine very easily. So the feeling is very strong that this is best done locally. But the state is stepping in to hire upwards of a few hundred contact tracers to help provide what they're calling surge support when there is a large number of cases that may overwhelm local efforts. I know that they hired, or they're onboarding, several dozen this week, particularly bilingual contact tracers, as I understand is a pretty big need around the state. And the plans are to continue hiring more as they are needed. Apparently, they've gotten over 3,600 applications for contact tracing positions with the state so far.
We're talking to Will Cushman with WisContext, looking at contact tracing here in Wisconsin as part of the effort to safely reopen during the coronavirus pandemic. Now, you talked to someone doing this work for public health, Madison and Dane County. Tell us about her and what her day looks like.
Yeah, I spoke with a really lovely woman. Her name's Myrta Maneb de Macedo, and she is a public health nurse for Public Health Madison and Dane County, as you said. She normally does prenatal and perinatal home visits all around the county, and usually works part-time, but since mid-March, she's been a full-time contact tracer. So she's working days and nights sometimes, calling and texting contacts of people who have tested positive in Dane County. And her days sound pretty long and stressful, to be honest. They start out with a daily meeting where all of the county's contact tracers meet and get new information. That's one of the things that's kind of stressful for contact tracers right now, is that COVID is still such a new disease that we're learning so much about it all the time, that as new information comes out, it may affect those interviews, those contact tracing interviews, and the information that they need to glean from people. So she sits in a meeting and then spends all day trying to get in touch with people. She said sometimes she has a hard time getting in touch with people. Sometimes she has to convince people to take the time to sit down for an interview. By sit down, I mean talk over the phone, because it's all done remotely. But sometimes those interviews can take upwards of half an hour or so. And she said that sometimes she has to do some convincing to get people to take it seriously. But I think overall, she said that she really kind of enjoys the work, even though it is pretty stressful, because she's a pretty social person. So I think it's really a job that's great for social people who like to communicate with the public.
And then flipping things around, Will, if I was to get this call from a contact tracer, what do I expect? What kind of things are they going to ask me?
Yeah, that's a really good question. They will not tell you who the person is, who tested positive, who you were in close contact with. The contact tracer I talked to, Myrta, says that usually people are already aware of the person in their life who's tested positive. But they'll ask you if you have any signs or symptoms of COVID. They'll ask you if you feel like you are able to self-quarantine at home for up to 2 weeks. At this point, after almost about 7 weeks of the safer at home order, I think a lot more people are kind of prepared for that self-quarantine if they have to. But there's a whole number of other questions that they ask as well. But yeah, it's a pretty extensive interview.
Does it get to be a bigger challenge if all the contacts we're tracing are, you know, the people in your household and that's about all you've seen versus the people at the store, the people, the strangers at the table next to us at the bar the other night? The more we're in contact with people, the longer these contact tracing efforts can take.
Yeah, that's giving contact tracers and local health departments some anxiety right now as we reopen. You're right. They are definitely planning for people to have more contacts now that businesses have reopened and people are going back to restaurants and bars and seeing more than just the people in their immediate household on a regular basis. That will definitely add to the workload for contact tracers and will make their work more complicated. But it's really what they're going to have to do now going forward.
Do you get a sense that the state feels like they have enough contact tracers for where we are right now? Or is this hiring effort something that's going to take a couple weeks to kick in?
My understanding is that the state is still trying to tally how many contact tracers there actually are working around the state. A lot of local health departments have kind of like Myrta here in Dane County are using employees from all over their department to do contact tracing. So there isn't really a set number right now, but the state's still trying to figure out how many there are actually doing contact tracing right now. I think the goal is to have upwards of 1,000 contact tracers working pretty soon. But yeah, they're definitely going to be looking at hiring more people well into the future.
Will, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rob.
That's Will Cushman from WisContext with us to talk about the latest on contact tracing efforts in Wisconsin. You can read more at their website, wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, the presidential campaign is looking and sounding a lot different these days. We'll look at the latest from the Trump and Biden campaigns during our look at the week in Washington. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, many college campuses are trying to figure out how to safely reopen this fall. Some have already decided they'll still be virtual. A higher education reporter looks at the tough choices facing colleges around the country. First, it's time for our look at the week in Washington. Senate Republicans are holding off on taking up a $3 trillion economic relief package passed by the House. The presidential campaign is sounding different these days as the economy suffers and in-person rallies are on hold. And President Trump revealed this week that he's been taking hydroxychloroquine, an anti-malaria drug, to protect himself against the coronavirus, despite the Food and Drug Administration warning people not to take it outside of a clinical trial. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What have you thought of the president's communication during this pandemic? Has his handling of the pandemic shifted your view of President Trump? Maybe your vote, for better or worse? How are you looking at his decision to take this drug despite FDA warnings? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Lauren Gambino is a senior political reporter for The Guardian. Lauren, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start off with a listen to the president talking about taking this drug, hydroxychloroquine. Here's the moment he first told reporters.
I happen to be taking it. I happen to be taking it.
Hydroxychloroquine?
I'm taking it. Hydroxychloroquine. Right now, yeah. A couple of weeks ago, I started taking it. Because I think it's good. I've heard a lot of good stories. And if it's not good, I'll tell you right, I'm not going to get hurt by it. It's been around for 40 years for malaria for lupus, for other things. I take it.
And what have we heard from the president and the White House about his statement that he's taken the drug since then, Lauren?
He's faced a lot of questions about whether he is actually taking it because he put out a statement from the White House doctor that wasn't explicit. So he's been sort of oddly kind of in this back and forth with reporters, insisting that he indeed is taking the drug. And his team has also doubled down that indeed he is taking this drug. So that's been sort of the first wave of reaction. He was also on Capitol Hill yesterday, again, touting the benefits of this drug. And he actually made a comment that, you know, had some doctors and researchers really surprised. He said, some of the research that suggests this drug might not work on hospitalized patients was a quote, Trump enemy statement. So it's turned this sort of drug that is in the trial phase. We're not sure whether it will work in treating coronavirus patients. And it sort of turned it into another political sort of football in a way. And researchers and doctors are getting really nervous about the efficacy of some of these tests if people are worried about participating because of all the coverage of the negative side effects of this, or vice versa, if people are very eager because the president is touting it. So there could be some real implications to this discussion over whether over the president's support for this particular drug.
What kind of reactions have we seen from others in the political world, in Congress and elsewhere this week?
I think most notably seen a response from Nancy Pelosi. She was asked on CNN about this, and she said that she would prefer the president not take a drug that isn't fully endorsed by the FDA. And she said, particularly in his situation, which she referred to as morbidly obese, and that caused its own chain of reactions to her calling the president obese. And she's doubled down on that today. Other members, Republicans, have sort of said it's up to him and his doctor, and that's the decision that they've reached. And I think you're sort of seeing it fall again on partisan lines. Democrats are pretty critical of this approach, while Republicans are sort of letting the president do the speaking on this one and sort of saying, it's his choice.
And has President Trump talked about the potential for confusion? And we've seen on Fox News, Neil Cavuto, after the president made that statement warning viewers, hey, don't try this at home, in effect. Others even supportive of the decision, pointing out to do this along with your doctor. Has the president clarified whether this should be taken as advice?
He's actually really come out in the last day or so and attacked Fox News, particularly Neil Cavuto, over his reaction. And so I think you're getting mixed messages from the president. Of course, his team is saying, the White House itself and some of his press secretaries have said, obviously follow what your doctor says, and this should be done in trials, and you need to discuss it with medical professionals. But at the same time, Trump is saying, I've heard from friends that this is great. And so I think there's some really mixed signals, and especially for his supporters who do tend to get their news around coronavirus from him. I think that, it is certainly sending mixed signals, and I think we'll have to wait and see whether there's actual real-world implications of this.
Talking to Lauren Gambino from The Guardian. It's our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. Turning to more COVID-19 related news, we saw last week the U.S. House passing another major economic relief bill related to the coronavirus pandemic, also known as the HEROES Act, they're calling it. Now, the next step would be the Senate. And what are we hearing from the Senate on this, Lauren?
The Senate is far less eager to take up the next phase of the stimulus package. And that's because they want to see how the money that they've already allocated, they want to see how that affects the economy. So they're in sort of this wait and see. Mitch McConnell has said, let's give it a couple weeks. That being said, there are some Republicans, especially in states that have been really hurt badly by the coronavirus. Louisiana springs to mind, where these Republican senators do hope for more money to flow to the states and local governments that are really suffering. So there is some sort of low boiling pressure to do more, but it's likely not going to happen at least for a couple of weeks, at least according to the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. That being said, we might see some smaller action, particularly on the small business loans. Nancy Pelosi has signaled that she is willing to address that sort of separately, because there's been a lot of concerns from small businesses across the country that the last stimulus package that Congress passed, the sort of framework for getting these small business loans is just unworkable and very difficult to use. And so there is some bipartisan support for changes to this particular aspect of the stimulus bill.
Republican senators had a lunch with President Trump yesterday. Coming out of that meeting, was there anything they were talking about, apart from what you just mentioned, those the small business part of this, that they did sound like they wanted to work on, or are we just on hold as far as more economic recovery efforts for now?
Like I said, there were a few senators who said, you know, Trump sounded open to another round of stimulus money, that Mnuchin as well sounded open to it. And certainly we've seen the Fed chair, Jay Powell, he has really, he's couched his words carefully, but he's essentially said, you know, we are going to need more money to flow to the American people if we want to, you know, stave off serious economic damage. And he was testifying on Capitol Hill this week. So I think you're seeing a lot of pressure build. But again, yeah, it might just be a few more weeks until we see, you know, until Republicans think they have a clearer picture of the economic situation as these states start to open up.
And we see other action in the U.S. Senate, a committee approving a subpoena for documents related to Hunter Biden. This includes Wisconsin's own Ron Johnson on this effort. Do we know anything about what they're looking at and what the timing might be on that sort of thing?
Yes, this is so this is sort of what Trump has been pressuring his allies in Capitol Hill to do. This actually, an aspect of this was sort of a part of why Trump was impeached way back when. He was trying to pressure Ukraine to look into some of the dealings surrounding Hunter Biden. So we know that this this is something that is very partisan. Democrats are very opposed to it. Nancy Pelosi just put out a statement condemning it. And Democrats on the committee voted against it. Effectively, you know, they're looking to see if there was any sort of wrongdoing in Hunter Biden's dealings with China. He worked for, without getting too wonky, China has now become sort of a central theme in the presidential campaign. Trump is going really hard, blaming China for the coronavirus pandemic. And so if there's any sort of family connection, if you could tie Biden in any sort of wrongdoing to the nation, I think the president really thinks that could be harmful to Biden's campaign efforts.
We'll get into the presidential race more in just a bit. I want to bring on a caller. Stacy is with us in Menasha. Stacy, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Stacy?
I have two questions. The first one, I'm wondering if the gap for the 17-year-old dependents that are home is being addressed at all in the next wave of stimulus. And also, and I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but is the drug that the president is allegedly taking perhaps backed by a company that backs his campaign, and would that have anything to do with the reason that he's touting the drug?
Thanks a lot for the call, Stacey. Lauren, for the first point, the 17-year-olds weren't included in the check for dependents in those the payments under the last round of economic recovery. I haven't heard of anybody saying, let's do that next. Have you?
I was just going to say, you know, I haven't heard that, and it would be something worth checking up on, and I will do that. I just, you know, I don't offhand, I haven't heard of that.
And then she was also asking about a financial stake in a company that made hydroxychloroquine or quine. There's been a PolitiFact thing on that, saying the president has a small financial stake, but not much is the gist. Have you seen any conversation about that issue, Lauren?
Actually, yeah, that seems to be the upshot. That there is, it's a very small financial stake, and Yeah, and in the end, it seems that, that Trump is sort of more motivated because he's heard this from friends, and he's someone who is, you know, does take the advice of friends very seriously, whether or not they are experts in the area. And that seems to be sort of one of the motivators behind his support for the drug.
Thanks, Stacey, for calling in. It's our weekly look at the top news in national politics. Lauren Gambino is with us, political reporter at The Guardian. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we're going to turn our attention to the presidential race. Want to know what you think about how COVID-19 is shaking things up, if it's changing who you might vote for in November or reinforcing the decision you might have already made. And the how of campaigning. Would you go to a political rally this month, next month, in August? I don't know. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Lauren Gambino from The Guardian, looking at some of the week's top news in national politics. Lauren, I want to turn to the presidential race, and you've recently reported on this and how President Trump is adjusting his campaign to account for the pandemic. What have we seen in terms of the president's campaign message?
Yes, so he, you know, had anticipated running on a great economy, and clearly that is not the case anymore. And so he started to shift his message. He's really trying to hammer the vice president, Joe Biden. He's, you know, trying a few different tactics. Certainly, he's already nicknamed him Sleepy Joe, and on that front, he's really trying to raise some questions about whether, you know, Joe Biden is up for the job, whether he's got the sort of stamina and can sort of build enough enthusiasm to really energize voters ahead of November. On another front, he's really targeting China. He is trying to shift, you know, to really blame China, I would say, for the spread of this virus. You know, as far as we know, it originated in China, and he's trying to sort of draw a direct line, in a way, pushing back on some of his own the criticism of his own handling of this pandemic. And in doing so, he's trying to tie Biden, saying Biden's, you know, always sort of been weak in his in standing up to China when he was vice president, and saying that his son Hunter has these ties to China and China's business leaders. He's also taking, you know, various tactics. They are raising the allegation against Joe Biden. His campaign has not shied away from that, despite the fact that you know, the president has also faced many more allegations of sexual harassment. And so they're just trying, you know, it looks in a way like they're trying many different things, and especially in these swing states. So in Wisconsin being, you know, a swing state, they're really going to hammer Biden over his support for trade deals, for TPP, and try to make the case that, you know, that the president is really the one who's on the side of workers, and not Joe Biden, who kind of has this brand of being, you know, working class Joe from Scranton, Pennsylvania. So, yes, like I said, they're just trying to many different things to sort of chip away at Biden's popularity, which has risen in recent weeks. And polling does show Biden up at this moment in several key battleground states, including some showing him up in Wisconsin. So it certainly comes at this pivotal moment in the campaign, when candidates can't be on the trail and they can't hold rallies. So they're kind of using, you know, the airwaves to really attack one another. And the Trump campaign has a ton of money, and they're doing it very aggressively.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Logan is with us in Green Bay. Logan, hi.
Hi. Thank you. What I wanted to say, sir, that whatever Trump says shouldn't be taken seriously. His veracity is in serious doubt. Many times he made bombastic statements, which eventually came to nothing. And I feel that he is not capable of handling the crisis. And I concede that it's an immense problem, but he has come nowhere. And you can see what he's doing is constantly discounting information given by experts. And I feel that his reign should end. Thank you.
Logan, thanks for the call. And Lauren, some people have made the case that, hey, this election is going to be potentially a referendum on how President Trump handled the coronavirus pandemic.
I've talked to a lot of strategists on both sides of the aisle, and that's what they seem to think. You know, typically, when you're running against an incumbent, it is a referendum on their presidency. And, you know, what has been bigger than the coronavirus pandemic? You know, we're approaching 100,000 people who have died from it in the U.S. You know, unemployment is very high. And so they think, you know, how the next few months will really be telling in terms of whether people trust, whether people are willing to give Donald Trump another 4 years. And as we were talking about before, Trump is actually trying to change the conversation. He doesn't want, you know, the polling has showed that there is, he is not, people are very critical of him, let's say, and they are critical of his handling, as the caller expressed. And so he doesn't want to be talking about that right now. And that's why I think you're seeing a lot of these attack ads focus on other aspects of the campaign that aren't really related to coronavirus.
Talking to Lauren Gambino from The Guardian, looking at the week in national politics. So we talked about the Trump campaign strategy. What are we seeing from the Biden campaign at this point?
So the Biden campaign is in a unique position because Biden is off the trail. He's at his home in Delaware. He's got to, you know, run his whole campaign. The joke is from his basement in his home. And he doesn't have the platform Trump has. He doesn't have a governing position, so he can't really weigh in on, you know, the policy, or he doesn't have a say in the policy and how we move on from this crisis and you know, begin to repair the economy. So he's really, what he's trying to do is he's trying to just get on as many, you know, he's calling in, making TV appearances. He's doing a lot of local news, local press. He's having, as we saw today, he is having two events in Wisconsin. Obviously, those are virtual, but he is trying to target voters there in the state. So he's trying to, in some ways, recreate the campaign trail and do it so virtually. In other ways, he's really just trying to get out there and you know, be as visible as possible, given that obviously he doesn't have the bully pulpit that Donald Trump does, or even that some of, you know, his Democratic allies who are governors have, because he's just not in government at this moment. So, yes, I think you're going to see it. Possibly being in Wisconsin, you might see a lot more of him in the coming weeks.
Are people talking about, hey, we're hoping we can get back to old-fashioned rallies by X date, by a certain period in time?
You know, what I thought was really telling was even Donald Trump, who really, you know, loves his rallies and wants to get back, he said in a Fox interview a couple weeks ago now that he didn't think a rally would happen before, you know, the end of the campaign, if even then, but, you know, September, October. Biden's campaign, they want to demonstrate what they believe is good behavior, they want to show that they are staying hunkered down until public health experts say it's okay to go out. So he will be there until the sort of public health landscape changes. And so, you know, I think we're just going to be looking at a very different campaign season for the next several months, maybe the rest of the cycle.
And how about those party conventions? Milwaukee was supposed to host the Democratic one. I think the Republican one was going to be in Charlotte, North Carolina. Last I saw, Republicans were still thinking of going ahead with all in person. I think Democrats, I haven't seen the latest, up in the air on what's going to happen in Milwaukee. What are you watching for what are often the marquee events for each party in a presidential election year?
Well, some of the big concerns are, you know, this is sort of the moment when you introduce your candidates of the whole nation, and you know, there's the balloons and there's all these speakers, and it's just a big seminal moment in the campaign where you define what you're running for. And to not have that, there's a big question. Democrats are far more uneasy about holding this convention. They have yet to sort of hammer down exactly how they will work it out. But one big question is, you know, will the networks block, hours of TV each night of the week that we're supposed to hold this convention to air our speeches? And if they don't, you know, then how do we get our message out? You know, how do you get, like, the whole point of it is just, you know, again, introduce your candidate. So how do you do that without a big convention? The Republicans are much more bullish on their ability to hold a convention, but I think there's still just a lot of questions about how to do that, who feels safe coming. That being said, you know, the president is really eager to do this. So, maybe they find, you know, a workaround where you have far less attendees and, you know, taking all the necessary precautions. But I think as you said, the Democrats, it's likely to look very, very different. And even the Republican one, if they do go through with it, it's also likely to look much smaller and spaced out, very different from what we're used to, the crowd.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Lauren Gambino, senior political reporter at The Guardian. She joined us for our weekly look at some of the latest stories in national politics. Today marks a special day in the history of clothing, and I'm celebrating. I'm commemorating the day by wearing what I wear pretty much every day. On this day, in 1873, a pair of inventors and clothing salesmen in California submitted a U.S. patent claim for a pair of work pants reinforced with metal rivets. And so a uniquely American piece of clothing was created by a Latvian immigrant tailor named Jacob Davis and a Bavarian immigrant shopkeeper named Levi Strauss. As reported on the History Channel website, the first patent for what we now call blue jeans was a team effort. Levi Strauss had created this brand of indigo-washed denim pants, and they sold like crazy. But Jacob Davis, one of his customers, made them even more durable by adding metal rivets to make the buttons more secure. And so the blue jeans were born. But why was blue the color? I did some digging around. It looks like the indigo dye has this special property. It dyes the surface of the fabric without sinking in all the way. That gives the jeans their unique blue and white look, which looks even cooler as they start to fade over the time. To mark the occasion, I am wearing blue jeans today. I also celebrated yesterday by wearing blue jeans and the day before. Probably going to do it tomorrow, too. Fashion news you can use. This is Central Time.